This is
an exclusive hot
hanger. Hey, it's Stuart McKelvey, and you're listening to Why to How, a podcast where we explore adventures in STEM. On today's episode, I'm joined by Anne Makaczynski, student inventor, keynote speaker, and CEO of Makatronics Enterprises. Anne has been participating in science fairs since grade 6, making it through to the Canada-wide science fair in 2012, and winning gold in 2013 for her project, the Holo Flashlight, a thermoelectric flashlight powered by the heat of your hands. Since then, she's gone on to win the Google Science Fair, presented on The Tonight Show twice with Jimmy Fallon, presented at 5 TEDx events, has been included in both Time Magazine's and Forbes Magazine's 30 Under 30 lists, was named Popular Science's Breakout Young Scientist of the Year, has sailed the Northwest Passage as a youth ambassador, presented at events all around the world, and has even appeared with Miley Cyrus for Converse. Anne, welcome to the show, and might I say, wow, what a bio that is.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Of course. First guest on the new Why to How Adventures in STEM podcast. Pretty exciting.
Super exciting. I'm so glad you guys are starting one.
Well, so are we. And you seem to have had such an incredibly diverse range of experiences already, and you're only 23, so I imagine it seemed like a bit of a whirlwind these past 7 years.
Oh my God, it's been 7 years. Yeah, it's definitely been a bit crazy.
It's been 8 years since you attended the very first Canada-wide science fair.
Yeah, my first Canada-wide science fair, I believe, was when I was in grade 9 or grade 10. I don't quite remember, but it was with my piezoelectric flashlight project, and it was in PEI. It was in Prince Edward Island, so I know they rotate around Canada, whichever location year that was. Yeah, it was super fun. It was definitely quite a life-changing experience for me just to meet all these kids that were my age that were like working on science fair projects and super excited about it. I just didn't have that at my school, and I only met like the local science fair kids on Vancouver Island where I was competing, but I had never imagined or at least conceptualized that all over Canada there were these amazing, awesome kids that were also super excited about their projects.
Yeah, and I imagine going from one very small island to another was quite a bit of a jump for grade 9.
Yeah, that's true. I never thought about that. It was from Vancouver Island to PEI. I actually remember like taking some of the red soil and keeping it in a Ziploc. Yeah, I was very excited.
And now you've traveled and then all around the world.
Traveled, and yeah, that was the start. Many places still left to go. Sorry, my cat has may jump on me at any moment.
Okay.
She got excited.
Excellent.
I think she's sitting down on the desk now. Okay.
Wonderful. So, Anne, talk to me a little bit about young Anne. Your father was a lab manager and your mum was an artist. So I imagine that unique combination of parenting made for quite an interesting childhood.
Yes. I mean, my mum was from a very tiny town in the Philippines, and my dad was born in Poland during World War II. Mm-hmm. And then as a teenager moved to England and then to the States and then to Canada. So it was definitely very interesting people coming together and having child, which was me. So like my first toy was a box of transistors and other electronic parts. And from there, I would take my hot glue gun and garbage from around the house and kind of piece together my very first inventions, which was like made out of needing something to do and something to play with. So, of course, they never worked. But this kind of idea of taking the resources around me and piecing them together to make something better came very naturally. And my dad was working at the University of Victoria for many, many years. He's retired now as a lab manager and scheduling person that worked with students. And my mom, she'd actually studied in university teaching ESL, English as a second language. And then she actually became a secretary at a dean's office, also at UVic, eventually, after moving to Canada. But she is very much now into sculpting and painting. And she always was very good at art, but she didn't pursue it as like her profession. Mm-hmm. And she makes these amazing busts of people. And I'm just like, I do not have the same skill yet. Maybe when I'm in my 50s, I'll like rediscover it like my mom. But
I'm sure you'll get there. Yeah, of course.
I hope
maybe a second lockdown. Yeah. Something to keep you busy.
Second lockdown, I just get super into sculpting and ceramics. I could definitely see that.
Yeah. And would you describe yourself as a curious kid then?
I was very curious about how the world worked. Ugh, I feel like everyone says that. I'll
make that a snippet for our social media.
I was trying to discover. I remember I had a book called How Things Work, yeah. And it was very exciting for me. I wonder if I still have that. Anyways, I was just always asking questions, and I found that science or art could explain the answers for anything I wondered about. So I was very much reading from a very young age, mm-hmm. learning and also watching. I was raised on silent films from the 1920s, as well as operas. Yeah. And very limited TV. So it was a very interesting childhood for sure. I was super also into collecting any dead animals that I saw. So people would like bring dead birds that had like crashed into their windows to my mom's work or to our house so that I could have it. I wouldn't do anything with them. I would just collect them in the freezer. And we used to have this huge collection of dead animals of usually birds and sometimes like rabbit feet when UVic used to have rabbits still. And then my mom made me throw it out a couple of years ago, which is fine. Totally understandable. She was like, I don't want to eat ice cream out of this freezer. I was like, I get that. I understand.
Yeah.
Anyways, that was a bit of a ramble.
So boxes.
You just look like, oh my God, who did I invite
not at all.
This podcast?
So yeah, so box of transistors, hot glue guns, dead animals. Like that's a pretty normal childhood.
Bugs.
Bugs.
I was also really interested in bugs. I would like collect them because they were like free toys in the backyard. Yeah. What could be better? So I would collect them and I would spray them with water every morning before I went on the school bus to school. And I would eat them. I would go to the Victoria Bug Zoo a lot. I still go every time I go back to Victoria, let's be real. And I just love bugs. I think if I had the patience and the self-discipline, I would actually have studied entomology and then become a bug insect expert. But I also hate spiders, so I don't know how well that would go.
Yeah, that is a niche study, isn't it? All insects except for spiders.
All bugs
yeah.
except spiders.
I mean, I'm sure there's lots of people out there just like you, though, so it's fine. So I like that you call yourself a tinkerer, and I wonder at what point do you think that you decided to take your tinkerings and then turn them into more of a formal science fair project as it was?
Oh, gosh. Well, my first science fair project was in grade 6. Mm-hmm. And it was very much a combination of I had moved schools in grade 4, and all my old classmates and old friends at my old school at St. Margaret's had to do science fair as part of the curriculum, but my school didn't make you. So I would go and look at their science fair projects as my parents would take me every year beforehand. And I was like, I want to hang out with my old friends. So in grade 6, I did my first science fair project, and it was very much like me testing the water. So it was literally a project I'd done in school that I leveled up a bit, and it was like comparing laundry detergents.
Nice.
But from there, I like caught the science fair bug where I was like, oh my God, this is so fun. I get to work on something in science that I love outside of school. And then I get to make a poster, and then I get to present it. And then I get to get people's reactions. It was basically like me being a theater kid, but in science.
Yeah, a perfect combination of your parents.
Because you know, the important thing about science fair that not enough people realize is when you're doing a science fair project, it takes a lot of skills in the arts as well. Readable, first of all, you have to write a whole report of a certain amount of pages that has to be readable and comprehensive. Then you have to make a poster board that is both visually appealing and gives all the information. And then you have to practice presenting it so that you're able to explain your project to a professor in that field or to like a 7-year-old kid that passes by. So it teaches you a lot of skills in both the arts and sciences. And I don't think enough people give science fair credit for that.
That's a very good point, and definitely something I think we could all take to heart a bit more, is that recognizing just how important the presentation and art side of science actually is.
Yeah, and obviously I'm not saying like it's all about presentation, like it's not like that superficial or whatever you want to say, but that is a big part, because I would go to science fairs and there would be these kids with these amazing projects, but if they couldn't articulate it well, then nobody would understand or get how cool what they were doing was. So I think science fair in general should be maybe there's some updated version, which is now, I guess, like startup-esque or entrepreneur-y competitions. But I think it's such a valuable skill for all kids to do and have in their middle school or high school years, because it teaches you so much. And sometimes you do, mostly you do the projects alone or in a group of two, maximum three people if you're like really young. So you learn a lot about like self-discipline and like pushing yourself or you and your partner to like finish a whole project. Which is a little kid, it's pretty hard. And as an adult, still hard to finish things.
I can guarantee you, it's still definitely hard. So what was your experience like at these science fairs? And I guess, was there much of a difference? Because you obviously started off at school fairs and science and regional fairs, and then you made your way all the way to Canada-wide science fair. So is there much of a difference between the levels?
Oh, gosh. I see. No, I keep saying, oh, gosh. Just edited that out or keep it in. Whatever. The Vancouver Island Science Fair, I'm so grateful for, because they were so amazing and supportive and really welcomed kids from any school or different parts of Vancouver Island. And my school did not participate in science fair at all. And they actually were like, why are you doing this? And then I told them, well, I love doing this. And then they got excited about it once, you know, I was winning awards.
Of course.
And then I remember walking into my middle school, middle school principal at some point when I was doing them in like grade 7 and 8, and I was like, well, why aren't more kids doing science fair, because it's like super fun and I'm learning so much. And they were like, they voiced concerns that all schools have, which is A, you know, the kids may not actually do it, it might end up being all the parents' work, and B, it might take away attention from our own curriculum. And I was like, this should be part of the curriculum. Like, this is the most valuable experience. Like, I probably learned more in science fair than I did majority of all my other classes in high school, except, like, I guess I learned a lot in my English literature classes and my drama class that I took, actually, and marine science or environmental science. Those are probably my three favorite classes in high school and stuff. But yeah, I just, anyways, off topic. Vancouver Island Science Fair was wonderful. It was great. There're just so many little kids there too that were just so adorable and had these amazing, hilarious projects. Yeah. And then I went to the Canada-wide Science Fair two times. I went to the one in PEI and I went to the one in Alberta in Lethbridge. Those were really, honestly, I just had such an amazing experience of making these, my first outside of school friends, because they were from different schools or different areas of Canada. And I really made some very valuable friendships. One of my friendships, who you should totally interview next, her name is Catherine Bowman, and she went to the Intel Science Fair with me, and she was my roomie for both of the Intel science fairs that I went to. And she just has become like my second mother, and we like check in with each other whenever, and she's doing really cool stuff, so you should definitely
she is.
Anyways, do you know
her? We actually went for a hike last summer together just randomly.
God, that's so funny. Okay, were you in Alberta?
Yeah,
or was
in
this
Alberta.
When she was back?
Yeah.
Okay. Very cool. Well, I'll have to tell her now that I just spoke to you. Anyways, yeah, so Catherine was just such a great friend to have. And yeah, it was a wonderful, wonderful experience. And the Canada-wide, and also first loves, first crushes, science fair when you're a teenager. I mean, that's probably the most exciting thing.
Oh, this is a goss I was looking
for. Team jackets. And you got to have your team jackets or team hoodies. The one thing I object for that I hope Canada will fix for the next Intel Science Fair is that this is such a small thing, it's kind of stupid, but for the Intel Science Fair we all got like Team Canada jackets, mm-hmm. but they would always give us hoodies with like fleece lining, which is appropriate for Canada, but all the locations were either like LA, Arizona, or somewhere on the East Coast,
hot
so it's always like
yeah.
so hot. And I was like, I don't want to wear my team jacket when we're walking around. It's so hot. That's the most minor thing that I shouldn't even voice. But I still have all my science fair regalia. I have all my badges in like under the bed somewhere mom stored. And it was truly an amazing experience. Intel Science Fair. Well, first of all, when you go from your local science fair to the Canada-wide, it's like, whoa, there's hundreds of projects. Yeah. When you go from the Canada-wide to the Intel, there's like 1,500 projects. Like there, and there's multiple halls for each different areas and categories. And it really feels like you are at a competition. And it's truly an awesome experience. You can definitely feel the tension of silence and like murmuring in the halls when judging is happening. And I was so lucky a few years ago to be invited back to speak on the alumni panel at the Intel Science Fair. And it was in LA, which is when I had gone as well. It was also there. And I just had this huge flashback moment of like being in the halls and like feeling this excitement and nervousness. Is truly such an amazing experience that I hope everyone or anyone listening can try and apply for the Intel one once you I think you have to qualify for the Canada-wide. I'm not sure how it works. But it's truly an amazing experience, and everyone on your team you become so close with. And yeah, it's just amazing. It's so exciting. I have no words for it. Just Science Fair completely changed my life. I'm sure if I did it as an adult, it would also be super fun, but probably not the same feeling that you have when you're a teenager. Mm-hmm. There's something so special about being a teenager and being that young and feeling like I'm doing a grown-up cool thing and I'm going to present my project, hopefully astound the judges or be extremely embarrassed by them because when I don't know the answer. But I really learned so many valuable skills in Science Fair, truly.
And that's a thing that I think a lot of people don't realize, is that it's not even just about the science sometimes. Like, it's about all these other things that you get to do, all the other people you get to meet, you get to step out of your comfort zone, you get to work on your public speaking and your presentation, your social skills. You also get to go to these cool places, go to these cool events. It's a whole experience. It's not just science.
It's a whole rounded experience, and I don't know why more schools are like, here's the Science Fair, you should compete, you should do it. And then lastly, I was really lucky in my beginning of my grade 11 year to go to the Google Science Fair in Mountain View, which was an extra just amazing experience to have because it was on the Google campus in Mountain View. And it was a very surreal moment and definitely one of the key life-changing parts of my life. I hate saying that, but truly it was a life-changing experience that really made me realize, like, if I set my mind to something, like, anything is possible. Like, I can, I don't know. It was an exciting moment as a 15-year-old, for sure.
Oh, I can imagine. And you won a whole bunch of awards at both Google and ICEF. So that's a lot of awards for a tinkerer.
Yeah, it was definitely fun. It was obviously fun to compete and, like, hope that you won something. Mm-hmm. But it was generally the experience of the whole fair and all the friends and people I would meet and traveling that. And obviously the projects that I was making that really brought me and motivated me to complete my project and go each year. And when I did science fairs, I got in high school, at least I would, it, the science fairs in May would happen at the exact same week that all the classes had to go on out trips in my school, like camping. Yeah. And so I was like, this is great. I get to stay in a hotel while my friends sleep on the dirt. Like, this is amazing. But I love camping. I'm Canadian. I love camping. It was just an amazing experience for sure. Yeah.
And I really like that point that it's not about competition. So people shouldn't be doing science fair purely for the competition and hoping to win awards. That's not what science is about in general, and that's not what science fair should be about either.
Yeah, and I felt, though, that there weren't many, many people who made it to the higher competition levels that were in it just for the money. Because by that point, people like that were eliminated because you could tell that they weren't as passionate about their projects or that they just didn't have enough of the actual information and knowledge about it. It was more just, I want to enter so I can win something. There's definitely, I never got any like rude or competitive remarks at any of the science fairs that I've done. Maybe I was just very oblivious and it happened all behind my back, but I always felt a very friendly atmosphere between everybody that was there.
I mean, we hope.
Sometimes it was a little weird at local fairs or smaller fairs because I felt like there are a lot of guys around me and I'm the only girl here. I'm not the only girl, but like there were less girls, but I was just kind of like, whatever, like I'm here to do my thing. I don't care how many girls are here, how many guys are here. But that was just me.
You just do your own thing and you're there for the science. You're there because you love it. So it doesn't matter who's standing next to you. Right. So let me ask you, where did the inspiration for your projects come from? So at first it was a piezoelectric flashlight, right? And then that changed in the next year to your thermoelectric flashlight. And then following onto that was an e-drink, which was powering your phone using the excess heat from the mug, right?
Yes, yes. So actually in grade 7, which is the second year I did science fair, I was already playing with Peltier tiles, which I used in my flashlight. And also in grade 8 as well. I think it was always kind of drifting towards the alternative energy space, playing with solar cells, Peltier tiles, piezoelectrics. And the main inspiration behind me choosing to create a flashlight instead of like a radio, or like I made a solar sandwich that like floated in water. It was very weird. Was because my friend in the Philippines, because I'm half Filipino, mm-hmm. she had written to me and said that, hey, like I failed my grade in school because I didn't have any light to study with at night. So I couldn't see my notes. My home has no electricity. And I just, you know, I was seeing the time and I found it so shocking that someone who was just like me, just in a different part of the world, didn't have something as simple as light. So I decided to base my science fair project around her problem and create some sort of light source that wouldn't require any batteries. First, I actually made the piezoelectric flashlight, which not a lot of people know about that, I suppose. And then I went on, hey, that harvests the kinetic energy of humans. It's super noisy and tedious to use. What if I harvest the thermal energy instead? Mm-hmm. And that's when the holo flashlight was birthed, was born, came into the world.
I mean, using body heat seems to be a little bit easier than watching you up on stage at a TEDx event trying to crank your flashlight to
yeah. I mean, and there are a lot of hand crank flashlights and things like that already that exist. Yeah. So I wanted to do something a little different. And I'm just a weak, muscle-less person in general. So why would I want to hand crank something?
Exactly. Yeah, make it easy on yourself, right?
Exactly.
It's really nice, though, that you got your inspiration for science fair projects from wanting and the desire to help other people, especially in countries like the Philippines.
Yeah, and I think if you choose problems that are kind of more close to your heart or you have a personal connection with, especially at a young age, it is really hard to finish a project. So if you have something that personally motivates you or you actually want to make a difference in your friend or your family members or cousins or communities' lives, that's a lot more motivating for you to really follow through and try and make something. And it's more exciting when it works.
Absolutely. And that's not even just for science fair projects. That's just for life. If you choose something that you really have a passion and an interest in, then it's going to be way easier mm-hmm. to sit down and get the work done than it is if you're just doing something
totally.
For the money or for the fame. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You don't go into science for the money or the fame, let's be real.
Yeah, you don't. And I mean, I feel like when I jumped a little more into the entrepreneur space, especially the young entrepreneur mm-hmm. space, I saw a lot more people who were in it for the money and the fame, which is why I think it was kind of valuable to come into the entrepreneur space as a science fair geeky inventor, yep. because I was much more like, I just want to make things. And everyone else was like, I want to make things, but then I'm going to hire someone to make something and then I'm going to market it and then get money this way and get investment. And I was just like, I just want to make things, which also wasn't always a very valuable thing and hasn't been a valuable skill in that department for me, because when it comes to business stuff, I'm kind of like, and then I just end up not doing great things in the business world or things I regret later on. So I think kind of what I really need to find personally for myself is a balance of being an inventor, but also having some knowledge and a foot in the entrepreneur world so I can make wise decisions when it comes to marketing my ideas. Because we all got to make a living at the end of the day somehow. And I just hope I can do that by creating and doing what I love.
And it's all a learning experience as well. And I think what you'll end up finding is that you just need to get yourself to a base level on all the different aspects involved in allowing you to continue to be a tinkerer while also making a living. And then you just ask for help when you need it, right?
Exactly.
But talking of fame, you've been on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon twice now to present two of your projects. How was that?
Oh, it was fun. It was a great experience. The first time I didn't have any contacts on and I very much need glasses to see anything beyond this. So I was just could not see that much during the first time. But the second time I had contact lenses and it was very fun. Everyone remembered me. Jimmy is super mm-hmm. nice. The crew is really nice. It was a great experience.
I can imagine. Yeah, it's definitely a unique experience that not many people get to experience in their lives.
Yeah, I feel like after that, my first time on The Tonight Show, a bunch of like young inventors were suddenly like, how do I get on the show? Like, how can I do this? But yeah, it was a fun experience. And I hope one day to return with future inventions.
Hope so too. Yeah, it'd be great to see you on there again. So just before we move on to what you're up to these days, now that we've covered off your childhood and schooling lives, could you give us an update as to where you're at with the Holo Flashlight and the e-drink mug? Because I believe you were in talks for a manufacturing deal. Were you able to improve their efficiency?
Yeah. The e-drink, I don't think, is commercially viable at the moment, just because of the efficiency of the Peltate tiles is less than 10%. Mm-hmm. So you really got to drink a lot to get a small boost of energy for your phone, even though it is a fun idea. I think once Peltate tiles efficiency becomes drastically improved, so it can work and produce a large amount of power with small temperature differentials, because a Peltate tile, you've got to heat one side of this tile and you've got to cool the other to produce a small amount of energy. So that means the greater the temperature differential between the hot side and the cold side, the more electricity is produced. But when I'm working with the palm of my hand and a hollow tube or aluminum, you know, tube or fins to cool it, it's very small amount of degrees Celsius temperature differential. So I'm working with very small amounts of energy. For the e-drink with boiling water, it did work substantially better, but again, it's still quite low. So this kind of branches into what I'm doing currently for the past 2 years. 2 years? Oh my God. 2 years I've been working on a line of children's toys that run off of green energy, and a lot of them implement the flashlight's technology into the toys, and I patented the technology, or at least the design, which is great. Because it's just not marketable yet, in my opinion, unless we get an amazing team of people to work on it. That would be great. That's a whole different story. But right now, I think the best way to put the flashlight is in toys to help inspire kids to want to do science. And the toys would all be eco-friendly, hopefully, et cetera, and sustainable. But it's really hard to get the Holo flashlight comparable with battery-run flashlights. And even things like solar-powered flashlights are kind of a lie, because most of them have storage batteries in them, or else they wouldn't work when the sun's not out. So we still have a while to go, but I am super excited about it. I think it'll just take a while. It's not like on my mind every day that I'm, you know, maybe if I was more entrepreneur-minded and I'd set out from the get-go, I'm going to get investing, I'm going to get a team of people, I'm going to move to San Francisco and start my flashlight startup. But that was never really the goal from the get-go. I just made it a science fair project, and then it exploded because so many people were excited to buy it or inspired by it. It's been an interesting process, but I hopefully some of the toys will get picked up. I've been pitching them to different toy manufacturers and companies, and we'll see what happens.
And accompanying that is a picture book series that you're hoping to launch as well.
Oh, gosh, I need to send you an updated bio. I'm so sorry. We were working on some picture book ideas to go along with the toys. Right now, I can't tell you yet. If you had interviewed me in a month I could have told you. I have two very exciting deals on the table related to different things that I enjoy doing that are related to me being an inventor in general, that I am very excited for. And yes, that is all I can say. But
the key takeaway for our listeners is that you're still tinkering and you're still inventing, and you're also trying to be creative at the same time. That's all we need to say.
Exactly. I'll have some exciting news soon, I hope. I'm still definitely writing some ideas.
Excellent. And so I guess the big question I have for you then is, why is this work so important to you? Like, why do you keep inventing? Why do you keep tinkering? Why do you keep going through all the effort of lining up deals with children's toys and book publishers and TV shows? And why do you give yourself more
because
work?
Because it's what I like to do. It's just what I like to do. I don't know what else I would do. I mean, I guess I am really interested in acting and film in general. So that's kind of something else. I moved to New York to start studying acting back in June 2019, and I was until COVID, and then things have been different. So I don't want to do online acting classes at the moment, maybe later on. I just love creating things and telling stories. I think I just love telling a story. And whether that be through inventing something that can help others and it will generate stories for other people, or through the toys that I would write stories about, or for TV shows or books, writing for that. I just love, that's just what I love to do. And that's probably just stemmed from me being a kid and not being given a lot of things to entertain myself passively. So I had to actively entertain myself. And that was usually through writing things, making things, drawing things. I'm basically still a child. That's why I have pigtails on. I just wanted to feel youthful today. So,
and yeah, it's a great way to live. Yeah, more people should hang on to their youth as long as possible. We get too serious as we go
on. Yeah, and we go too serious. And also, I think it's also like, sorry, I said like twice. I grow older, we shut down ideas more quickly that we have in our brain. Like we think, oh, that would be so cool if this existed, or if I did this, or what if this happened, and then this and this. And then we're like, no, that's not possible. It's too much work, too much time, too much money. And so kind of my mentality is, if I'm like, oh my God, that's so cool, or if someone says something interesting, or someone tells me a story, I'm like, that would be such a great scene in a movie, I'll just write it down. Mm-hmm. And I'll just like, I just do that all the time, but with thoughts in my head. So I basically, I guess inventing for me is kind of a way to embrace and almost live in my imagination, but also look to the present for problems or things to solve or link my inventions to. And I think inventing is also a way of creating your own future, or other, or helping to affect other people's future with something that you make. So I think the imagination in general is something I'm very passionate about.
Yeah, you want to hang on to that youthful naivety and optimism, as it were.
Yes, but then you get really disappointed when real life hits. You're like, the adult world sucks.
That's why naivety is important. So you can be like, oh, that's fine, and just do it again.
Yeah.
Talking about temperature differentials, you should create a patch that goes on windows in Canadian winters, because it's very cold outside and it is quite toasty inside here.
To be built into the window. Mm. That would be pretty cool.
But you love to talk about the concept of bringing art and science together. And I loved that your LinkedIn bio even mentions that you're an inventor and a creative. So why is it so important to promote this convergence of what seems to almost have become competing ideas?
Well, you can kind of look back to even Steve Jobs, or even later on to, or in the past, to like Leonardo da Vinci. As a kid, I always used to get Leonardo da Vinci and Leonardo DiCaprio mixed up. I don't know why. I just remember that. They're very different. But, you know, you can look back to Leonardo da Vinci, who was both an artist and an inventor and a scientist. And I think that's kind of like this Renaissance man or woman role that I would love to embody in some way with my work. Because I think it also comes from being told so much as a kid and in society that science is a career, art is a hobby, and they're very separate, and you should only do one of them. And so maybe me saying I love both arts and sciences is like a secret deep down rebellion against my parents, or what schools have told me and whatever, like, I can do both, just watch. But I do genuinely believe that the combination of arts and science is what leads to the best innovations, to the best products. You know, if you look at our iPhone, it's a combination of the technology and the iOS working amazing, but also it looks aesthetically pleasing. It's nice to hold. It's a beautiful product. We kind of expect technology nowadays to be part of our fashion. And so I kind of want to do that with anything I invent or create, is that it's both a mix of art and science. And I found that very helpful. Again, going back to science fairs, it was like, I get to present, I get to make a poster, I get to write. So it's all these other skills that are needed, not just the science and research skills. And just in the inventing process in general, for me, it usually starts with me sketching things and drawing, and then physically modeling it and going on from there. And I think showing how the arts and skills you have in the arts you can bring into the sciences or to your science fair project will hopefully encourage a whole new group of people to embrace inventing and want to become an inventor. And it's sad that, it's not sad, but like the word innovator is used a lot more nowadays. And I think that partially branches down to, first, it sounds more modern, but also the word inventor, when we think of it, we think of a bunch of like old man with beards, or Edison. I think he was bald. He didn't have a beard. But, you know, we don't really think of like a woman or a young person in general nowadays calling themselves an inventor. And I think that's kind of sad. I want to revive and hopefully inspire a whole new generation of girls and boys or whoever to want to be inventive and want to make solutions for their own problems instead of being a consumer and being like, oh, if something breaks, it's okay. I'm going to throw it out and help pollute the earth and buy a new one. So that's kind of, and it's kind of an old, it's not an old fashioned mentality, but it's been around like back in the early 1900s or in the 60s and 70s and 80s, 90s, when something broke, you try to fix it. When something breaks, my dad's like, let me try to fix that before I throw it out. If something tears a hole in it, my mom's like, let me try and sew that back up. And I think we should embrace that. And that will definitely lead to a more sustainable life on Earth and for the planet. It'll be great. So I forgot what I was talking about. But in general, arts and sciences should be taught together. And I think there should be classes in the Canadian curriculum that are literally like, you have 3 months, here's your group of two people, you have to create an invention or an app or a project and implement it in a friend or family members or in the community and then come back and present to us. Because that would be so much more effective than like, here are a bunch of physics questions on velocity you must do every week. That's what was, so that's why I never, I mean, that's not why, but that's one of the reasons why I never did super well in science in high school was A, I was so distracted with the science fair. B, math was never my strong point. I had to do Kumon, which is like a math and reading tutoring company program. I took math lessons from there from grade 3 to grade 12, and then I still like tutor there occasionally because math was never natural for me. Kumon helped a lot, though. I recommend all parents send their child to Kumon. Even if the child hates it, keep sending them to there. And then three, science class was not a very, unfortunately, inspiring experience for me because it was just like, okay, we're gonna like do more textbook questions today, or let's make circuits with Play-Doh and check the resistance with, you know, it was just not exciting. I had fun because my friends were there, and I just like love to make my class laugh in physics class because I just did not know the answers for anything. So you'd be like, F equals MG, what does MG stand for? And I'd be like, milligrams, and I was just a horrible student. And chemistry also did not come naturally for me at all, but I ended up doing physics in summer school, and I had to do it every day for like a month, like morning to night, and I passed and I got a good grade, so I know I can do it. It's just I prefer the tinkering, I prefer the hands-on part and being more creative, and I hope schools in Canada can implement a more hands-on experience when it comes to science. That's not just like chemistry beakers or the occasional dissection of a frog. Like, I hope it's more than that in the future.
Yeah, I mean, just to do a very small little plug for YSC service offering, which is Smarter Science. We actually promote project-based learning, which is all about student-led curiosity, inquiry-based questioning. It's testable. It's at a regional level. Teachers, you'll love it. But it's all about that whole concept of, like, let's just move away from the textbooks a little bit. Let's just move away from rote learning. And let's move towards more about empowering students to figure out what it is that they find interesting. How do we build project-based learning around that? And then that also brings in a combination of different subjects all at once. So you're not just learning physics. You're learning physics and art and history to build together, you know, one particular project.
I love that. I hope everyone does that. That sounds like an amazing... That's exactly what I was trying to explain.
Yeah. I think project-based learning is definitely the way of the future, and hopefully our education system can adjust to meet those new requirements.
Do that. Yeah. And I think when students feel like what they're working on in school can actually make a difference in someone's lives, or in their own lives, it's so much more exciting than like, I'm going to do these physics questions and I'm going to get a good mark, but nothing else is going to really change in life, if that makes any sense. I just feel like science would also just be a much more meaningful experience for young middle schoolers and high schoolers if they feel like I'm going to make something from my brain with a few other brains, and then we're going to actually help people with it. I mean, that's kind of amazing. And I think we're kind of taught in high school, like, or at least it even starts in junior school or middle school, or like, okay, you're going to get to go to high school, and high school is going to be really exciting because then at the end of high school, you get to apply for universities. And then when you go to university, you get to get your degree and then maybe you go on to more schooling or you get a job. And I feel like that's at the point once you graduate university that you feel like, okay, now I can start making a difference in the world because now I'm certified. But I think if kids are taught, hey, when you're young, you know, you can also start doing stuff outside of school that can make a difference. I think that's what's really exciting about science fair as well.
Yeah. And also innovation comes from not knowing something, and to not know something, you almost need a combination of two things you do know. So it's that unique connection within your own mind that someone else doesn't have, whether it's a difference of opinion, difference of learning, difference of understanding or life experience. That is when the unique comes out, and that's when you discover something great.
Totally. Agreed.
So do you have any mentors or idols that you looked up to growing up or that you have now?
Real people that I actually knew.
It doesn't have to be.
Because there's two categories for me. There's like people that I idolize that they're all dead or nearly dead. And then there's ones that are alive or that I did know. And so I'd say my main mentors right now, I mean, my parents, obviously, would be this couple named Heidi and Gary in San Francisco that I met back at the Google Science Fair when I was in grade 11, and they have just become my second parents / advisors for life. And they're so kind and so experienced in the business and entertainment and science world. And they're just wonderful, wonderful people. And my manager, Nan, has also taught me a lot about the business world, entertainment world, which I'm very grateful for. And then also I was really lucky to know as a child until he unfortunately passed away, the musician, the Indian sitarist Ravi Shankar, because my father was filming him quite a lot. And so growing up with his whole family around me and his daughter Anushka and her mom Sukanya have just been the most loving experience that I've had in my life, other than my parents, I suppose. Now, dead people that I do not know, I have a whole list because I started being obsessed with Harry Houdini, the magician, in grade 6. So I learned all his magic tricks, watched all his movies, read all the books, did everything, renamed myself Andini in order to honor him. So half the people in my life think my name is Andini, which I've just kind of let fly. I would love to change my name to just Andini, because I feel like more people would remember that than Anne Makasinski. And it's looked so long. Everyone's like, Makoskwatsky. And like, they just don't know how to say my name. So I feel like Andini would be more straightforward.
Yeah.
Then in grade 7, I was inspired by Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, the dancing duo from the 30s. So I was taking ballet lessons for a year. Very embarrassing. I just put their photos on my agendas, you know, did all these things. Yeah. And then it was always being, I was obsessed, I still love the opera singer who's Polish called Piotr Bichała. He is by far the best tenor alive, and I'm very supportive of his work. He inspires me because he just performs at such a high level and is the best at what he does. Elvis Presley, I'm obsessed with. And Anne Margaret and Richard Chamberlain and Harold Lloyd, Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin, Basil Rathbone, all these kind of older actors that you just don't know who I just talked about. I just love people who dedicate their lives to creating something. Or Mel Brooks. I love Mel Brooks. I just want to meet Mel Brooks. I am obsessed with Mel Brooks. I have a Mel Brooks hat. I watched all his movies. I went to see him on Broadway when he had like an interview thing last summer after I had experienced anaphylactic shock only a few days earlier. I scrambled out of bed and I went to watch Mel Brooks because I was not going to miss Mel Brooks. I love Mel Brooks. I just love people like Mel Brooks, Charlie Chaplin, all those kind of people that were able to have an idea in their head and then they ended up writing it, directing it, producing it, acting in it, writing the music for it. I love people that are multi-talented in a variety of areas and put it all together into something amazing. I think that's kind of my ultimate goal in life, is to bring together kind of my passions for arts and sciences into a lot of different things instead of keeping them very separate. I think that's my overall goal in life. I just understood that now. This feels like a therapy session. Thank you so much.
I'm happy to help. Anytime. Do you have advice for people as to how to find mentors, whether dead or alive, and you know what to actually look for in someone to idolize?
Look for someone who's not asking or saying, don't look for someone who's saying, oh, I'm only going to help you if you follow exactly what I say and nothing else, mm-hmm. or I'll only give you these connections if you do what I say, or I'm only going to do this if you give me a certain amount of money. Don't use people like that. Use people who genuinely are super excited and open and are interested in what you're doing and love. And oftentimes just reach out to people you admire on LinkedIn or on social media, but LinkedIn's always better because I feel like less people kind of reach out sometimes on there. Yeah. And write a little sweet message, because a lot of times people who are older than you will see a younger version of themselves in you, and they'll want to help you. You never know what you're going to get until you, oh my God, wow, I got so excited. Yeah. I kicked my tripod and then I caught my phone at the same time. Wow.
That's a talent.
Talent. That's the only amount of sports that I've retained from high school, catching my phone whenever it falls on my face. And just look for people who are inspiring to you and mm-hmm. reach out to them, because you really never know. A lot of people will respond back. Well, not a lot, but you know, a decent amount. And, I always found people in history just to be very interesting, and history does repeat itself. So to some respect, so a lot of people in history that are very inspiring are still inspiring nowadays. Mm-hmm. And perhaps I preferred it if they were dead, because that would mean they're unreachable, which makes them more magic. Did I say undead or dead? I would prefer if my idols sometimes were people who had already passed on, because in a sense it made them more magical and ethereal and something I could never really reach or attain. And sometimes meeting your idols is not a great, you're kind of like, oh my God, they're like a normal person who's like shorter than me. That's terrifying. So, you know, it's definitely, everyone has a different preference of what kind of idol they look for, but you usually know at a certain age, these are the areas of, maybe it's sports or movies or science or writing. You know what you love generally of like interest, and then you look for idols in those areas that you can look up to. And there was always something about everyone that I've obsessed over that I wanted to like pull a little part of them into me, and for me to embody some part of them. I'm still trying to understand what that is, but I kind of feel like all my obsessions that I've been so obsessed with over the years, I've pulled a little bit of them into my essence or whatever you want to call it, and kind of felt more confident and stronger about myself because I'm pulling and referencing them in my daily life. If that makes any
Absolutely.
Sense.
Absolutely. Yeah. I like to think of it along the lines of, you know, that famous quote, as it was, that you are the sum of the five closest friends you surround yourself with. And I feel like it's the same with mentors and the people you aspire to. You don't have to be another person. That's not the whole point of finding an idol or a mentor. Like, you don't want to be that person, but you can just take like the best parts of a whole bunch of different people and you know, whether dead or alive.
Exactly.
Whichever you connect most with, you can be that part of that person. But you don't have to be the whole person. That you don't have to change who you are.
You don't have to be the whole person. You don't even have to be part of the whole real person. Like, I don't want to be John Travolta, but I do want to walk like him in the beginning of Saturday Night Fever when he's walking to the music, to the Bee Gees. When I walk the street, that's the time I feel the most confident about myself. If I'm, like, listening to 1970s music and, like, walking like I have somewhere to go, like, that gives me so much confidence. But I do not at all want to be John Travolta. So you can, like, pull, that was a horrible example, but you can pull from your different people you look up to and be like, I want to be part of that. I want to have that passion. And sometimes it's even like dressing like your idol will give you a weirder sense of confidence or feel closer to them, or eating what they, I mean, you could go on and on, but
yeah.
And I mean, there are people who are like actually obsessed though and go maybe too far. Like someone who's obsessed with, I saw some like video on YouTube of someone who was like obsessed with Barbie, and then they like got all this surgery to be like Barbie, and then was like, I am this robot that travels around the world. People take pictures with me because I look like Barbie. I mean, there's definitely different levels of obsession. I'm not saying you should go like that, but there's ways of finding people who inspire you and being like, how can I be a little bit like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think it's important when you are reaching out to these people, be honest and be sincere. Like, don't pretend to be the person you think they want to hear from.
Yeah, you got to be yourself. Yeah. But also, like, don't write them, like, a whole pages of text, because they'll be frightened away. Yeah. I will tell you that right now, because I've had people write to me like that.
Yeah, don't give them your whole life story. Just be nice.
Not on the first meeting.
No.
Yeah.
So, moving on to what you're up to now, some people were probably quite surprised to learn that you didn't go on to study science at university. Instead, you studied English literature at the University of British Columbia, and now you're studying English language and literature letters at the University of Victoria. So, after hearing you speak about combining arts and science, it doesn't quite seem like a surprise anymore. But what made you want to study English?
Right. Well, when it came to the end of my grade 12 year, I became very confused on whether everyone kind of expected me to go into engineering and that's why I felt like I should do it, or if I really wanted to.
Yeah.
And I had had a lot of pressure from home, honestly, to go into engineering, because that's all my parents talked about at the dinner table every night. And my parents in general knew a lot of professors or like science-y-esque people, at least in Victoria. And I had gotten all this attention, and everyone was like, well, and everyone starting in grade 11, when I started getting interviews, or even right before that, were like, so what do you want to do when you grow, when you're older? Like, what do you want to do in university? And I was like, I guess engineering, because, you know, that's what it felt like people wanted me to do. And then I realized I loved science, but since the get-go, since I was very young, looking back on all my diary entries, I had written, I either want to be like an inventor, an archaeologist, or a filmmaker, or just be in film. And I did have this huge passion for film, and nobody knew about it because nobody in interviews would ask me about what are your other interests. You know, it was always like, tell me your story. How did you come up with your invention? How was the experience of the science fair?
They're my first three questions.
What do you want to do in the future? Well, I'm used to that. Now I can elaborate a little more and talk more freely. But back then, when I was 15, 16, I was like told a very basic story myself. And I didn't think anyone could possibly be interested in my other things. And nobody did ask me what my other interests were. And then I started realizing when I was in grade 11, after I won the fair, when I started getting all these video crews coming to my home to film me, I was like, I kind of like this. This is kind of fun. And I was learning so much about how people were producing things and behind the scenes, the camera, the lighting. And it was a great learning experience for me of learning how it was both behind and in front of the camera. And also public speaking, which kind of took off for me after I won the fair, was very much training that I had no training for public speaking, but it was very much like I've done science for so many years that is presenting. And I had done all this theater when I was a kid and in middle school and high school, and I loved performing. So it kind of became this thing where I was like, I have this huge passion for film and for writing in particular. But everyone wants me to do science and I still want to invent things. Why is there no, like, what I really would have appreciated, and I think I would have chosen ultimately, is to do a university like Gallatin in NYU, where they allow you to do two different degrees in completely different fields. So I would have done one in kind of a more science or electronics-based one and one more in film. But I was rejected because my grades were not good. So then I just like, okay, well, let's do English. And so I ended up going to UBC. I loved it. I was still getting my patents for all my inventions, public speaking, inventing more outside of school. And then inside of school, I was learning about storytelling and film. So I've always wanted to pursue both. And sometimes it was hard because it was like, well, if I really just sat down and didn't go to any of these talks, and if I just studied engineering and stayed here, stayed put, maybe I would be more successful in the science fair field or science, sorry, in the science field. But then I realized that's not me. And also, it was such a great experience and opportunity as a 16-year-old, 17-year-old to be offered, hey, we'll, you know, travel to Germany or travel to Iceland or travel to all these places, to South America, and speak and, like, have this amazing learning experience as well as earning money speaking and meeting cool people. So I was like, I can't miss out on that. I just can't say no. That's not – I would regret that for the rest of my life. And, you know, maybe later in life, I would go back to school and get an engineering or an electronics degree. But at the moment, else going on outside of school, that is just not feasible unless I like stopped everything, which is the last thing I would want to do.
Yeah. And I think it's important that you say inside and outside of school, because they don't have to be mutually exclusive and you don't have to do them all inside of school. You're allowed to have other passions, you're allowed to have other hobbies and other interests, and it's not a bad thing to pursue one thing at school while you do something else on the side. But I imagine there's probably quite a lot of students that do participate in science fairs every year and have a passion for science, but then they're possibly thinking of exploring a different interest at university, for example. How did you approach that subject with letting the people in your life know, especially people who had put, you know, other expectations on you?
So much time, yeah. I mean, it was mainly my parents, which has always been school in general is just a hard subject to talk to them about. But I think it's just because they want the best for me, and they want me to have my degree and have a steady job and settle down, and because that is a very secure way, and they won't worry about me. And me moving to New York, studying acting, and then maybe having these deals happen, and then living this very spontaneous life to them is kind of like, oh, what, our child, we put so much effort, what has happened? But I do take a lot of their teachings, especially about time management or attempting to time manage, to heart. It was definitely a difficult subject, and I did. I remember consulting a few friends I had in grade 12. Of like when I was writing a letter to UBC saying, sorry, I don't want this engineering scholarship. Can you put me in your Arts One program instead? And just phrasing that and kind of figuring, because like great, you know, when you're 16, 17, you don't really, I mean, you may have an idea. And some people are like, I want to be a lawyer. I've wanted to be a lawyer my whole life. That's it. But most people don't really have an exact idea of what they want to study. So that's why I feel like, So that's why I feel like going to university and doing general first couple years is very valuable, because you can try a whole slew of different subjects and see what you hate, because that's very important to know what you don't like doing. And you can only find that out by trying to do it, and what you really love and which classes you're crazy about. But yeah, it was a difficult decision, but I'm really happy with it. And I don't regret it now.
I imagine though, especially I'd say like the first 6 months to a year, even a couple of years after making that decision, there's always moments in time when you second guess if you made the right decision.
Of course.
How do you work through those feelings, and how do you get to a stage where you're like, no, this is definitely the path for me. Like, even if that is the case, like I know I've made the right decision for me and everything's going to be okay.
I definitely have times where I question it still when I doubt myself. But life must go on, so I try not to question it too much or go like, what if I had done that or this and this had happened, da-da-da. You kind of just have to accept that what's happened in your life was meant to be, and it's there for a purpose. And if you really want to make drastic change in your life, I think you can do it. But if you feel like, I don't want to, then just go with that gut feeling. I think following your gut feeling, what you've always been really interested in, when in doubt, I always look back to what I've loved since I was really little. And that's like, that's what I want to do now. I still want to be a kid, but I'm an adult, but I want to do those things that I've always loved. But yeah, it's hard. Sometimes I have huge self-doubt, or I look at other people kind of in my category of like inventing science girl. And I'm like, did I not do the right thing? Am I not getting as many gigs or jobs or brand deals like they did because I didn't follow science, or I'm not as a spokesperson of this? And then social media plays such a social media plays also just a huge stupid part of it all, being like, am I doing the right thing branding myself like this or that? And it's all kind of like superficial stuff. But at the end of the day, if you're unhappy with what you chose, change it. Don't stick with it. Do not do a degree because your parents are like, we really want you to do this. Do something that you're actually going to enjoy, because you're going to spend at least mostly 5 or 6 just getting your major. So make sure it's something that you actually want to do. It's my number one piece of advice.
Yeah. And I think that all starts with figuring out what your values are in life, what you yourself enjoy, and as you say, like figuring out what you don't like and what you do like, because a lot of the times we have these expectations of what we think something is going to be like, and then as soon as you start taking those subjects, you're like, oh no, this is nowhere near as cool as the movies make it out to be. Like, why would I want to do that?
Yeah, exactly.
And I think also it comes back down to, as you say, social pressure too. Like, we put all of this pressure on kids in year 12 to know exactly what they want to do for the rest of their life. And as you say, like, all of these people interviewing you are asking you already, like, what do you want to do for the rest of your life? And you're like, whoa, I don't know. Like, I'm 16. Like, give me a chance.
Yeah.
You don't have to get it right the first time. And very few people do. It's not a, you're not stuck in whatever you decide at 16 or 17 or 18. Like, you're allowed to huge, big life change midway through your life. That's what quarter life crises are for.
Oh, totally. And like, I have many friends that changed their degree after a couple years in, who changed the program they're in. But I do feel like university is very valuable for learning what you do not like, because you will take courses where you're like, oh my God, I cannot believe I'm doing 4 months of this. For me, I really was so awful at chemistry in high school, which I now realize is partially because I did not like it. So my brain just refused to have it stay in my mind. It would just go in one ear, out the other. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to show all those high school teachers that I can do it, that I can do chemistry. Yeah. So I took first year chemistry. I took a class in first year chemistry in my first year of UBC, and I did so bad, so bad. It's not even funny. I failed it completely. And that was definitely because I was just, first of all, I tried, but not, I didn't try hard enough because I hated it. Deep down, I just could not comprehend spending 4 years of my life studying this. And I was like, okay. So, you know, there's some things, unfortunately, to anyone who loves chemistry, I truly admire your strength to comprehend these math equation hexagon things, because I am just not at that level of brain levels. So anyone who is doing chemistry or chemistry related science or projects, I truly applaud you. It is the hardest part of science for me, and I very much appreciate what you're doing. But I, for me, just cannot do chemistry. But you really learn in university what you like and what you don't like. And I think it's a very valuable skill. And you get to get super into, like, the courses you do love when it's about something you're super interested in. It's so fun. Even the papers and all that stuff. Eventually, it is really fun. So,
I mean, that's how I feel about you doing English. I just, at no point has that ever been a favorite subject of mine at all.
Like, oh. I mean, definitely people question me about it at events. They're like, oh, why are you doing that? But now it's more accepted when I give, like, one or two sentences about why I love arts and science. They're like, wait, that's such a great idea. Like, I love that. So, and I've definitely had high school kids come up to me after I've given talks, and they've been like, thank you for saying that. Like, I really love drama, and I really love, you know, physics, and I don't know which one to choose. And like, you know, I think we don't usually, we typically hear of someone who's really successful in one field. Like, he's a really great businessman. He's a very famous actor. He said it. So I think, and that's usually what success is being really good in one thing. So I'm maybe for myself or in general trying to be like, you can be good at multiple things and bring it together and be successful and hopefully inspire other people to pursue their passions or to pick up hobbies in the arts or in sciences that they had ditched long ago or grown up and forgotten, and be like, let me return back to that and see what that brings into my life.
And it also depends on your definition of success, right? Like, money isn't the only definition of success. Sometimes it's how many people you can influence, 100%. How many people you can help, how happy you are living your life, how balanced your life is. Yeah.
Yeah. There's so many different definitions, and my cat is twitching its paws. It's dreaming right now. Sorry. There's so many different definitions of success, but I think in general it should mean, at least to you, are you pursuing what you love? Do you have the ability to do that? And I think that almost is a form of success, because a lot of people, unfortunately, aren't able to financially do what they love and financially support themselves. So being able to do that is such a huge gift and something I am very thankful for.
Yeah, absolutely. Moving on to a more fun question, just very quickly before we move on to something a bit more serious again. I imagine life is probably looking a little bit different for you this year to what we all expected. But if you were to describe a usual week, or maybe like what you hope a usual week would look like, how would you describe that?
A lot of Zoom calls, watching a lot of movies, watching some TV shows, writing a lot, drawing a lot, spending time indoors. I'm an introvert, so I'm totally fine spending all day inside. Yeah. Maybe going out for a walk once in a while to feel like a healthy human. Not online shopping. A good week looks like there's no online shopping happening at all.
Very important. Right now is Black Friday sales.
Oh, I know. What else? Gosh. A good week, yeah. And I'm living with my boyfriend right now and in New York, and it's been with our cat, and it's great. So that is a great, just existing is a, and being healthy is a great week for me.
Yeah, it sounds like a very balanced way to live your life, that's for sure. And quite different to the YouTube video about Day in the Life of Anne that you posted a few years ago, which is a wonderful video if anyone wants to get an insight into young Anne's life.
Oh, gosh. That was me trolling people because it's like, oh, so many beauty gurus do videos where their life is so put together. Mm-hmm. So what if I did a video where it was just me and my cat that I surprise adopted and told my parents, or didn't even tell them, like, hey, there's a cat in our house now. So I was abolished to the garage for a month after I got that cat, which is where that video begins, because we had a friend that was extremely allergic to cats coming over in a few weeks. And he was so excited to finally come because we had no cat in the house because our other one was dead. And I just ruined that. So I had to stay in the garage to make sure he didn't have a huge asthma, whatever attack when our visitor came.
Sound like a fun kid.
But it was still a very fun experience. Yeah. It was fun. I would like pirate movies and then watch them at night because there was like no internet in the garage. Yeah, it was a fun experience.
Different times indeed.
Different times.
So on the subject of getting to know the real Anne, I can imagine that there's plenty of people who want to learn more about you and your life. And because of that, you've gathered quite an audience on social media. So my first question, I guess, is how do you balance, you know, the personal you and the science you, especially on somewhere like social media where people often find you with a preconceived idea of who you are before even knowing the real you. So basically, like, a lot of people know you as, you know, the Holo Flashlight kid, but then on your social media now, you're completely, that's not you anymore.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can't stay the Holo Flashlight kid forever. And I remember at some point in Instagram when I was starting in 2015, 2016, I put in my bio, like, Flashlight girl, and now I'm like, I 100% want to get away from that because, oh my goodness, okay, oh, I flipped her over. How do I flip you back? Oh, wait,
yeah,
okay, there we go, disaster. I don't want to be the Flashlight girl forever. That's just, it would be horrible to grow up. It's like a TV star who's known for one TV show and they stay that their whole lives. It's like not fun. It's not fun. So, I'm really into my love for film. So I'll post a lot about film actors or old film movies that I love. And I post about Elvis a lot. And a lot of Elvis fan accounts have followed me, which I'm like, that makes me so happy. Yeah. Honest, so happy. And then I post a lot of modeling, brand, whatever stuff. Because, you know, I am technically still like a girl in science, and we need to have more visibility for that, and that they don't dress like they do in The Big Bang Theory, and we are kind of cool and we can, you know, embrace fashion and all that sort of stuff. I could market myself a lot better and be more on brand, but I kind of just want to post whatever I want to post.
You're being authentic.
That's that. Yeah. Being authentic, and maybe I am oversharing my life slightly, but it's never to extend. I never overshare too much because my mom checks my Instagram probably every day. So I'm like, no bikini photos, or only like once a year bikini photo. And also, like, Instagram is so weird. It's like set up for like us to be okay with random strangers commenting on our photos, which sets up this whole thing. If you have more comments and likes, you're more popular, which means you're more successful. And that's why, like, all these, we see so many girls and models like posting all these provocative photos, and then I feel like, oh my god, well, am I supposed to post that so I get more attention and feel more successful? And then, like, what success is that even? It's not even success. It's just like weird, sorry, men giving you attention, and I'm like, I don't want any of their attention. Like, I just want to post like cool photos if I feel like it, and then yeah, whatever. So so many girls I know, almost all the girls I know, all have horrible relationships with Instagram. Instagram just sucks. So I'm trying to find a more healthy way for me personally to feel like I'm posting things I'm excited about or feel like I look cool in, but I'm not oversharing and I'm not encouraging. Oh, whatever.
Yeah.
It's just like such an annoying thing for me. If I truly had a choice, I would create a custom Instagram post once a while and I would send it to someone and they would just post it. And then I would not have to ever check my Instagram. But not at this moment in my life. I'll just wait. I'll wait for that to be possible. And I can't close my Instagram altogether because that is how so many brands and like online talks and things find me now, which is kind of crazy. So it's kind of like, what do I do? So I try to post when I feel like it. And it's not exactly what people are expecting sometimes, but I also don't like sharing half done work or like, here's a picture of my notebook and copy, like hashtag hustling because I'm working today. You know, I used to do that and now I'm just like, ew, who was that? Like 5 year old, like 5 years ago, old Anne, like I would never do that. So I'm either posting nothing about work or when I have a job or I have something come out, I'm going to post about it because I'm excited. And that's what I wish I could just post about is work related stuff. But, you know, gotta keep the Instagram alive so people don't think I'm dead. So, you know, I need to post at least once a week.
I think it's important, especially for someone like you who had so much fame as a kid, to also be posting authentic pictures from your real life so that people who are more impressionable, so the younger ones of your audience, can see that, like, oh, like, this is a real person and, you know, you're not just that one flashlight kid anymore. Like, it's important
thing. I'm not just this. I'm
exactly
this.
And it's important for people to realize
that. For everyone.
Yeah. Because as you say, a lot of people curate their content so much so that they're only seeing a very niche part of someone's personality when that's not what human beings are. That's not who we are. That's not who we are as people.
Exactly.
So what are the main messages, I guess, then, that you are focusing on at the moment and into 2021? Like, what is important to you that you're sharing on social media, that you're sharing with friends and family?
It's important that I share how much I love Mel Brooks so that somebody sees it and I can meet him before, unfortunately, he passes away at some point. Knock on wood, it's not happening anytime soon, but he is older now. That's very important for me. It's important for me to share about arts and sciences, how much I love that. It's important for me to share about my work and da-da-da. Those are the main things. I'd say just art and science, I feel like, is more what I'm passionate about. And when I have some announcements to make, hopefully, the next few months, those will be important for me to share, too.
And, yeah, that ties back into how much public speaking you're doing and stuff at the moment, too, is you're sharing all of these important messages because you do believe in both the message and the impact they can have on the people around you.
Totally.
Were you always a good public speaker? I know you said you did a lot of drama as a kid, but were you instantly confident in public speaking and presenting at science fairs, or is that something you've sort of worked on over the years?
I think I worked on it over the years, but I think I always loved talking. As you can tell from this podcast.
Yeah.
but I just love talking and presenting, performing in general. So it kind of came naturally, but I'm sure it also came from me doing speech lessons when I was like 6, because I had lost my front teeth and I had like a lisp or something. So my parents were like, she needs speech lessons. And then I did like a lot of old poetry readings. I did a lot of poetry readings with old Polish ladies as a kid on Saturday nights, and local theater stuff. And then I did a lot of theater stuff with school. And so, yeah, science fair was very helpful 100% for shaping myself and how I present and all that sort of stuff. And it's not just about being super eloquent on your project. It's also a little bit about your personality. And it's like, do I like this person presenting in the first place? As a judge, I would say. There's many factors. But it's, it's a very valuable experience that I hope everyone will be able to do at some point when they're a kid.
Yeah, that's such a good point. And, you know, further to that, I think one of my favorite messages of yours, it actually came up when I was watching one of your older TEDx talks, that my favorite line from the video was, I'm not the best in my class and I probably will never be, but I can think and I can solve problems when I see them. And if I can do it, everyone else can do it. And across a lot of what I've read and from your own social media, you're very upfront and honest about not being the smartest at school, even in science class. And I think science fairs in particular, but just STEM in general, has this perceived image of only being for the genius whiz kids, you know, the nerds. But that's not the case at all, is it?
That's not the case at all. It's definitely due to marketing and Hollywood branding people who do science a certain way, which is very unfortunate. So hopefully with the new content also that the entertainment industry produces, it can show a more realistic way for kids to look up to an inventor or someone in science. I forgot what you said.
Like, you don't have to focus so much on grades. You don't have to be the smartest kid. Like, it's curiosity is a more important the most important.
Yeah. Everybody's like, you must get good grades to make a difference or, you know, whatever. And that is very important. And I was very much into getting good grades for quite a long time. But then I realized, hey, the things I'm doing outside of school are actually affecting my life and other people's lives a lot more than what I'm doing inside. And 80% of learning in general happens outside of the classroom. So a lot of kids in middle school and high school and their parents should really be thinking, what is my kid doing after school? And what can they do with that time, which is the most valuable?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, being curious and staying curious, that naivety and optimism of your youth, and just having a passion for something is much more important than having to get the best grades, because, you know, life is interesting. Life can take many turns along the way. So if you don't have the grades to get into, you know, that one course, that one university degree that you're really hoping for, doesn't mean you can't either get back into that course later in your life or figure out that maybe there's a different way to have the same impact and same result in the end.
Totally.
Next question is, you have a particular and brilliant ability to present yourself as very down-to-earth and relatable, which can't be easy for someone who has seen as much success already in their life. I just wanted to say that I thoroughly enjoyed watching your YouTube videos and reading the many articles written about you. And something that caught my eye, especially because I perhaps don't see it presented as clearly as you expressed, was your comment about being careful to make it feel normal for girls to do science, and that they can also bring their potential passion for the arts into it. So I guess there's a fine line between supporting women in STEM and not making young girls feel pressured into doing something that they feel obligated to do. So how do we normalize STEM for women, but in general?
I think it should be STEAM.
STEAM.
It should be STEAM, which includes the arts. I think there's definitely a way to implement it more naturally, which should start in the high school and middle school curriculum, but also outside of school science camps, things like that. I'm hoping with some of the things that I'm coming out with in the next few years, we'll hope to encourage more young girls to enter the world of inventing in general. But yeah, I think bringing the arts into the sciences a little more and showing how they work together and aren't very separate can encourage and bring in a larger audience in general, whether they be girls or boys. Yeah, that's what I would say today. Sorry, I'm like running out of energy.
I only have one more question for you.
But so yeah, okay. But yeah, that's the main thing that I would say. And there is definitely a fine line. And I think we should be encouraging more girls and females to enter the sciences. But I think there's a way of doing it that's a little more subtle. And personally, as a kid, I kind of had the gift of ignorance of just not knowing that that was an issue. So I just like showed up and like did my thing and like I didn't really care that much that there were more guys. If anything, I was just like, there's more guys. This is great. So yeah, you know, I can definitely see why some girls, especially when they're younger, would feel more self-conscious that there were less girls around or feel more shy or, you know, whatever. And so some way of making them feel more comfortable is also definitely part of the experience. And just having more girl female role models in all areas of work, but especially sciences and innovating and being creative, I think is very, very important.
So then final question for you, to summarize everything, what is it that you're the most proud of?
I don't really like go to bed at night being like, I'm so proud of myself for doing da-da-da. I guess the story of the flashlight and the flashlight in general has inspired so many young kids to also want to be an inventor and to want to enter the sciences in some degree. And I've seen so many really kind parents send me like pictures of their kids who did their like school project about me or dressed up as me for Halloween. Yeah. You know, things like that, I think, is probably the thing I am most proud of in that respect. But I think career-wise, I still have a way to go for me to really feel very happy about what I've done, but I am excited for the future, for sure.
Well, Anne, I just want to thank you so very much for being our first guest on the Wired to How podcast. I know that
I absolutely
love this conversation, as I'm sure all of our listeners and those watching on YouTube will as well. You are a remarkable woman with a wonderful perspective on life, and I wish you all the best for your current studies and product developments and the book and TV series and your new announcements coming out in the next month or two. So keep up the amazing work.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much. Thank you all for joining us in this episode of Why to How, a podcast where we explore adventures in STEM. If you liked this podcast, consider leaving us a like on our social media. It's just ysc.sjc on Facebook and Instagram, ysc_sjc on Twitter. Leave us a comment with your favorite part of the interview and let us know your own thoughts on the topics we discussed. Please do share a link to the podcast or YouTube video with friends who you think would love to follow along. And if you're on Apple Podcasts, leave us a review, as it really does help us reach more people. We'll have another amazing guest for you on the next episode, so stay tuned for more. Until then, have a wonderful day and stay curious.